Good evening. Welcome to the class. We're going to be studying lesson 9, the first person in tonight's lesson, Queen Athaliah. Couple of housekeeping points. Obviously, everybody knows we don't have the class on Sunday. So the next class, Lord willing, will be a week from tonight. The handout for that class is on the back. That class covers four class periods. I mean, that lesson covers four class periods. Make sure that you've got on the schedule that you've got a copy of Change 2, because in Change 2, I changed the order of the reading. I didn't change the reading. I just changed the order of it. And the reason I changed the order is I want us to read Hezekiah about him more in the order of his life. If you read Kings first and then the Chronicles account, which may be a person's normal reading pattern, then you'll get out of sequence in his life, okay? And I think we'll learn more if we read the Chronicles account, if you read the Chronicles account first and pay attention to, you know, what year it is in his reign, what month, what day, as you go through all the reading, Chronicles first and then Kings. There's some other Kings in the readings too, so it doesn't necessarily mean the reading starts in Chronicles, but as far as Hezekiah, I want you to start in Chronicles. So make sure you've got Change 2 to the class schedule and see the order that the reading is in. And like I said, that lesson covers four class periods beginning next Wednesday. We begin tonight's study with Queen Athaliah. She was the mother of King Ahaziah, who had now just been killed by Jehu and Jehu's men. Now, who is this Queen Athaliah? Omri's granddaughter. Okay. So, being she was in the house of Omri, in the house of Ahab, would you expect her to be a good woman or an evil woman? An evil woman. Okay. So when she sees that her son, the king, has been killed, what does she do to her grandsons? Now just think about this, you mothers and grandmothers. What does she do to her grandsons? She has them killed. Okay. So, there was one son that was not killed. And what was the circumstance of this son not being put to death? Pardon? Who hit him?
His sister. His sister, who was the wife of the high priest.
Okay. She was also, she was the, sister of the king of Judah. No, no, you had it right. She was a sister of the king of Judah. She was the daughter of the king of, of Israel. She was the daughter of the king of Judah who was killed, and she was, and she married the high priest. Somewhere in there. It's confusing. But this would actually be, I think, the aunt of the young boy, who would have been an infant, because he was hid for how many years? And he became king at what age?
Seven.
So she hid him for 6 years. That's hard to do, is it not? Have you ever heard of hiding, you know, something right under somebody's nose? And that's what she did. And the safest place to hide somebody from King Athaliah was in the Lord's house. Probably the place she didn't go. And according to the reading, that's where the young lad was hid. Now, this certainly helped put an end to the influence brought on by the worship to the false idol of Baal, because this was in the Ahab family. Now, I'd given you a handout earlier about the influence of Ahab upon Judah, which is different sides, two different kingdoms. And that influence was Baal being brought in and how it had influenced through the intermarriage starting with Jehoshaphat, or the alliances starting with Jehoshaphat and the marriage through, you know, with his son into Ahab's family. But now, except for a couple of kings later on, Ahaz and Manasseh on Judah's side, this, you know, we don't see the influence of the Baals as much after she's killed. So he puts her to death. Now, we talked about this priest, Jehoiada. What role did he play in restoring a king, this young lad, to the throne of Judah? That's beginning in 2 Chronicles 23, beginning of that chapter. What role did Jehoiada, the priest, play in restoring a king? So see, here for 6 years, Judah didn't have a king. Only a queen. There was nobody from the throne of David sitting on the throne, you know, for these 6 years. I'm sorry?
He was like a farmer, while there wasn't no king, they would go to him for, you know, what they should do. It was probably not a
video, but, you know. Well, some of that very well could have happened. In 23:1, my version says, in the seventh year, he took courage. And so he does several things here. He enters a covenant with the commanders. These would be the people of the army. He gathers the Levites and the head of the households. He makes an assembly there in Jerusalem. And then Joash, the lad Joash, is brought out at 7 years old and is announced as king. And, of course, when Athaliah hears all the commotion, and she comes out, she's put to death. Now, how long did this priest live? This is really two lives, isn't it? And I don't know. In my own personal thinking, I can't help but think there was some providence of God in his life, but that's just my own personal thinking. But 130 years this man lived. Remember, David had written long before 70 and perhaps 80, you know, by strength, you know, was a man's life. That was written a number of years before. And so here, this man lives 130 years. But notice some things that he did. Okay. One was he brought Joash up to be king. Of course, he was involved in the hiding and keeping him safe and making the provision for him. All of those things would have been difficult within itself. He directed the death of Athaliah, the queen. And notice what he did in chapters 24 down and around verse 16. It says, Jehoiada made a covenant between himself and all the people and the king that they should be the Lord's people. It says in verse 17, they tore down the house of Baal, the altars and the images. They killed the priest of Baal. Then he set up watchmen to watch over the, watch over the Lord's house. And then it says in verse 21, the people rejoiced. So certainly Jehoiada was involved in Judah, in the king being on the throne, and in helping this young king to live righteously during this time. Now, talking about the king himself, why was his reign pleasing to God? Notice down in verse 2 of chapter 24. What was behind his reign being pleasing to God? Pardon?
The priest.
Is that with an S or without an S?
That one priest.
Okay, that one priest. Okay. So we've read quite often where a king would listen to the wrong people. Okay. Now we're going to see this king though listening to two different peoples, are we not? Here in the first part of his reign, he listens to Jehoiada. And because it says he did right in the eyes of the Lord all the days of Jehoiada the priest. However, there's some things he didn't do. And what is it that so many of these kings fail to do? Remove the high places. Now, I submit to you again, the high places that are not being removed are those high places wherein the people are trying to worship Jehovah God. Probably the removal has happened of those that would be used to the Baals and so forth, as some of the false gods. But that, in my thinking, tends to be more the high places that are left when the times that the king is trying to follow God's will. Now, when the king is not, it could be any of it that could be out there. But he didn't remove the high places. The people sacrificed and made offerings on the high place. Now, you could ask about, and I've asked myself about, well, what does that say about Jehoiada, the priest, who was instructing him? Did Jehoiada instruct him, you know, concerning the high places that were used to worship Yahweh? Now, I say to worship Yahweh, I'm using that accommodatively, because I don't believe that Yahweh, that Jehovah God, accepted that worship. Okay. So I'm talking in that light. But I asked myself, is that part of the instruction that Jehoiada gave him, or is it not? If it were a part of the instruction, then it would indict the king because he didn't follow it. But however, it still indicts the king because Jehoiada, I know, lived past the 23rd. Let me see if I got this right. Jehoiada lived past the 23rd year of Joash's reign. I know that. So he was well into his reign. And my point in saying that is he should have been able to stand on his own feet as far as right and wrong. And should have developed his own sense of ought as concerning those high places. What did he do as far as the temple? The house of God.
Put a plan together
to make the repairs that had gone on because the temple just had not been used and had been and was in disarray. And so you can read some things between the king's account and the chronicle's account. I think what had happened is the money was being collected from both the assessments, the taxes, as well as, you know, free will gifts. The kings had delayed in it. And from that point on, after Joash brought it up, which shows an interest in Joash's part in this being done, because he brought it up even to Jehoiada. Why is this not being done? Why is it taking so long? And it says that the Levites had not been acting quickly about it. And the Levites would have been under Jehoiada the priest. So they then just do it through the voluntary contributions of the people. It says, as each one gave out of his own heart. The heart is in the Old Testament, okay? As much as it's referred to as the law, the heart was involved before God. But eventually, the repairs got done. And so we see that part on in his life. But then Jehoiada dies. What happens? Okay. That's in chapter 2 Chronicles 24 and 18. Now, what happened in verse 17. Pardon?
He had different counselors.
He had different people that he listened to. That's right. I said verse 17. I should have said verse 18. And they abandoned the house of the Lord, the God of his fathers. Or did I say it right? Yeah, it is verse 17. Okay. It says, the princes of Judah came and paid homage to the king, and the king listened to them. So he forgot the advice and the counseling, the instruction that he had been receiving from the priest. And he listened to these men of Judah and paid homage to them. And they paid homage to the king, and he listened to them. So the house of the Lord was abandoned, like Neil said. Okay. Now, what was the result of that? It says in that same verse, wrath came upon Judah and Jerusalem for this guilt of theirs. Did God ignore it? How did he not ignore it? What did God do? Sent a prophet. What was the prophet's name? Zechariah. And Zechariah says to the king, why do you break the commandments of the Lord? Because you have forsaken the Lord. He has forsaken you. And so, because, what relation was Zechariah to Jehoiada? His son. So, would you think that the king would have had a fond memory of Jehoiada and taken an interest in the words of Jehoiada's son? Is that not what you would think? Is that what happened? He killed him. Okay. So, when we think about, at least when I think about Jehoiada's influence on this King Joash, I think of the idea is leadership. Leadership was essential back then. We've seen it. We see it with this king, and we've seen it with the others. Rehoboam. We can just go through the kings. We've seen the importance of who it is they chose to listen to and take their counseling from. Over and over and over again, we've seen it, and we see it in this case. Think about it in a family, how important leadership is. The family crumbles when we talk about the backbone of a society is the family. Well, it's that leadership in the family that enables the family to work. And when there's a breakdown in the leadership of a family, you're going to have chaos within that family. And it spreads from family to family to family. You're going to have a breakdown. You're going to have chaos in the nation itself. And we see that. We see a complete breakdown. We see a very poor family structure in our society. And we see even still that family structure being undermined. Case in point, 15-year-old boy, I think in Massachusetts, is asked to write a paper on why a same-sex family, is that the right word, should not adopt a child. So he does. And he uses a lot of scripture in his writing. I haven't read the article, but from what I've heard about it, it sounds like he, for a 15-year-old, he did good. Well, the superintendent of the school has now accused him of being a bully. And it's made national news. But that's the breakdown that's continuing, and it's going to continue. And what's that going to do to society? Because the leadership you see, within a family is broken down. Now, we can think about it. We can think about it in the church, the leadership that the elders are to provide. If the elders don't provide leadership, what's going to happen? Now, part of leadership is setting the right example. In a home, you can be trying to teach, you know, a young child how to hold a fork. But if the father's holding the fork like this, you're never going to teach that child. The father has to set the right example. And, of course, that's a simple example. There's many other examples that go, language and a host of other things. And the same thing that in the church. We're not going to turn there, but you could go to 1 Peter, for instance, in chapter 2 and verse 1, and see that the church is, the members are to, you know, refrain from malice and guile and hypocrisy and so forth. You can go to chapter 3 and verse 8 and to see what they are, the type of conduct that they are to engage themselves in. You can go to chapter 4 where it talks about times past were sufficient for you to have engaged in, you know, in the wanton style of living, but no longer. And then you get into chapter 5 and it talking to the elders, it says be examples to the flock. So while the flock is to live the way that he talks about in the letter, the elders are to lead and be an example in those things. What if they're not, you see? What if they're not? What if the elders themselves have malice and hypocrisy? What do you expect, you see? Leadership is so important. It was important among these kings. It's important among our families. And it's important in the church. Any comment before we move on? Thank you. Okay. Looking at the next king, Amaziah, how was his rule in 25 and 2 compared to David's? Okay. My version says, yet not with a whole heart. Okay, now, his father Joash had been killed, and so he kills the servants that had killed him. Now, who did he not put to death? The sons of those servants. Why? Well, it tells us why. It says, according to what is written in the law of the book of Moses, where the Lord commanded the father shall not die because of the children, or children die because of the fathers. So notice this concern by Amaziah for the law. Notice the concern. Well, Amaziah is going to go into battle. He's going to go to battle against Edom. And he has 300,000 men. But he thinks he needs more men. Where does he go for these men? Israel, and gets another 100,000. Now, was God pleased with that? So what happened?
A man of God came to him and told him, you know, that God was displeased with Israel.
Okay. And so notice what Amaziah, or what the man says in verse 8 of a 2 Chronicles 25, go, act, be strong for the battle. Why should you suppose that God will cast you down before the enemy? For God has power to help or to cast down. Then Amaziah says to the man of God, but what shall we do about the 100 talents that I've given to this army? I paid them, talent being supposedly, what, about 75 pounds? 7,500 pounds, probably of silver. I don't believe it says, that I've given to this army. What are we going to do about all that money I've given away? I've already paid them. Does that change things? Why not? Okay. It's not an issue to God. And I think about that. if I have to rethink something that I've done in my life and I need to change my course of action, do I need to consider the financial cost of changing? I can't hear you. Okay. And, you know, I think about this. You know, a person could take a job and maybe he didn't check out the job well enough. I don't know, but whatever happens, he takes the job and relocates, and then he gets into the job and finds out that the job requires him to act in a way that he considers immoral. So what's he going to do? He's probably spent money on relocating and such, and he quits. Now he doesn't have a job at all. What's he to do? Continue? Yeah. What about a church that maybe is into a social program and they've invested money into it, and then they find out that it's wrong and they're willing to change, but there's people there that don't want to change, and they're big contributors. And if they leave, which they very well may do, they may be left holding the bag to pay for this social investment. Do they just kind of wait it out till it's paid for and then bring it up? You know, God's not concerned about money. And that's something we have to keep in mind. Money should not be our consideration when it comes to anything we do in His service. Now, you say, what if I give till I'm broke? Well, all I'll say is this. We've got the examples of people who did that. The widow and her two mites. God said she gave more. Now, is He requiring that of us? I'm not saying that. But certainly, a desire for us to tend to ourselves is something that God will do if we put our trust in Him. Any comment or question? Okay. But Amaziah goes to this battle, and God gives him victory against Edom. You would expect Amaziah to come back thankful, would you not? How did he come back? What did he do? And then a prophet comes to him and says, why are you worshiping the gods that couldn't give victory? You remember their philosophy. You know, the way they looked at these gods is that the battle had already been fought between the gods. And so, in their thinking, the side that won, well, that was the God that had won, and that God was superior. Well, for that thinking, it would make Jehovah God superior because Judah had won the battle. But he comes and he brings the idols of Edom with him. Remember the king, well, this is going to be later. Later, we're going to see Ahaz. We're going to see what he does. That'll be in a week. We'll get to that. But so he brings these false gods of Edom and sets them up, even though he's defeated Edom. We see this lack of understanding of who God is. He's asking him, the prophet asked him in verse 15 of chapter 25, why have you sought the gods of people who do not deliver their own people? And so he stops the prophet from speaking to him and says, have we made you a royal counselor? You see, royal counselor. He wasn't interested in counsel from God. He wanted counsel from someone that he had appointed and would say what he wanted to hear. Again, this idea of who's your counselor and who would you allow to be a leader to help you out. So we see pride and we see arrogance with him. And so So Amaziah goes up against Israel in battle, and he's defeated. First John chapter 2, verse 16. It lists three things. First John chapter 2, verse 16. We understand lust of the flesh. We understand passions filled in marriage. We understand hunger. We understand these needs of the body and how strong they are within us. Esau is an example of that, you know, what hunger can drive a person toward. But pride is just as dangerous, you see. And we see these kings being lifted up by pride. We see that with this king, Amaziah. And now we're going to see it in the next king, Azariah or Uzziah. We're going to see it in both of these men. Now, Uzziah, looking at 2 Chronicles 26, also had a counselor. It says in verse 5, he set himself to seek gods in the days of Zechariah, who instructed him in the fear of the Lord, and as long as he sought the Lord, God made him to prosper. If you look at basically just his account in a summative way, he did right in the sight of the Lord according to what his father has done. And you look at his accomplishments in this chapter, you see that the accomplishments listed a primary military. It doesn't talk about, as we've seen with some kings, where he's gone out, for instance, with Jehoshaphat, and he sent the priests and Levites out to train the people in the law of God and going about to set up judges. You don't see it talking about those things with Uzziah. But evidently in his life, he tried to please God. But notice what it says in the verse, in the end of verse 15. What does it say happened? Notice in reading my version, at the end of the 15, it talks about his military prowess and so forth, and his fame spread, for he was marvelously helped. That help is from God, till he was strong. Who else did it say that about? What other king? Remember Asa? Till he became strong. Rehoboam, I think, is the one I'm thinking about. Rehoboam became strong. But we really can see the sense of it in both of those men. But in verse 16, when he was strong, he grew proud. What did his pride lead him to do? I'm sorry? I can't hear you. In doing what? Specifically. I can't hear you. Okay, what specifically? Okay. All right, he went into the house of the Lord and he tried to burn incense on the altar of incense. And then Azariah, the priest, goes into him and tells him to leave. He can't do that. And so this was courageous on part of the priest to go to the king and tell him, you've got to leave. And how did Uzziah react? He was angered, enraged, okay? And he took a censer to burn it, and when he did, the Lord struck him with leprosy. Now, I don't know for sure what age Uzziah was at this point. He became king, I believe, at 16. He reigned for 52 years, I believe. And that would have been 68 at his death. I know from reading he had to be at least 52 years of age at this point and probably somewhat older. So here he's an older man. But I bring up this idea of the root cause of what he was doing. It was his pride, you see. The pride that lifted him up and caused him to do. Proverbs chapter 8 and verse 13. You see the concept of pride and arrogance, an anger, and in this case, unrighteous anger, you see, that describes and characterizes a person when they give into this pride, when they let it get the best of them. And so, I said for your thinking, we talk about the lust of the flesh, and we understand that. But sometimes we lose sight of what pride can do to us. And it's in so many facets of our life. It can be the husband and what he says to the wife. It can be the wife and what she says to the husband. Just so many of the words that we choose to say can be motivated by pride. And we've got to check that. We need to examine ourselves. What is it that makes us say some of the things that we say? And of course, what is it that makes us do some of the things that we do? So, 1 John 2:16, keep that in your thoughts as you consider your own life. Any comment or question at this point? Let's look at Isaiah. Isaiah began his work perhaps toward the end of Uzziah's reign. You can see the kings under which he prophesied in Isaiah chapter 1 and verse 1. And so we'll be turning to that book. But it was several kings throughout this time frame in which he prophesied. But notice, if you will, in chapter 6. And it says there, in the year that King Uzziah died, and Isaiah talks about a vision that he has. Now, beginning in verse 8, what is it that the Lord commissioned Isaiah to do? The Lord says, whom shall I send, and who will go for us? Then I said, here am I, send me. Isaiah, putting himself into the service of God. And God says in verse 9, go and say to this people, keep on hearing but not understand, keep on seeing but do not perceive, make the heart of this people dull and the ears heavy and blind their eyes. And we've seen references to that in the New Testament. And he goes on to talk in this reading what's going to happen to the land. In verse 11, the cities will be laid waste without habitation, houses without people, and a land, a desolate waste. But then also in chapter 6, he offers a hope. And that's what this book is about. It's the sending word to the people of their sins and how they need to change, of the destruction that's going to come upon them if they don't. And then the hope, here it says, this hope is the stump that is the holy seed, Christ coming, forth. And so of the hope that's going to come for those who remain faithful to God or repent and turn back to God. So that's, as I see this book, is the book in a very, very quick summary. But let's notice some things beginning back earlier in the book. In describing the people, notice in chapter 1, verse 2, he says, children have I reared and brought up, but they have rebelled. Now how does he... What animal does he compare the children of Israel to? And I say the comparison is in a contrast. That's right. The ox knows its owner. The donkey knows its master's crib. But Israel does not know their own creator, the God, Jehovah God. And so that's the beginning of this book, the way it starts out. We see that God will no longer accept their worship. And he goes on beginning of verse 10. What to me is the multitude of your sacrifices? And we see Christ alluding back to these types of passages as he talks to the Jews in his day about they sacrifice, yet they don't worship God. Their sacrifices are empty. And so he continues that thought throughout together. Now, and he gives reasons. Verse 15 at the end, it says, your hands are full of blood. In verse 17, he says, you bring justice to the fatherless, or you don't bring justice to the fatherless, and you don't plead the widow's cause. And you can go through the next several chapters, and you'll see reference after reference, this idea of there being not bringing justice for the, you know, widows and the orphans. Just time after time that brings up. And then he says in verse 18, a verse that we've all heard many times, come now, let us reason together. Though your sins may be like scarlet, they shall be as white as snow. So in the midst of all of the rebuking, the strong rebuke, and what he's going to do, you know, toward them, you know, in punishment, yet he still talks about them turning away, turning back. But it's going to be based upon them becoming students of God, disciples, listening to the prophets, and reasoning from the law of God. And we can continue this reading. In verse 23, everyone loves a bride and runs after gifts. And again, here's the idea of the fatherless and the widows. In chapter 3, they're devouring the poor and so forth. In chapter 5, he talks about, in verse 4, he talks about the grapes. He says, when I looked for the vineyard to yield grapes, why did it yield wild grapes? Now we look down in verse 7, what are the grapes and what are the wild grapes? You see in verse 7, the grapes are righteousness, you see, justice. The wild grapes are bloodshed and an outcry. He goes to his vineyard and he looks for justice and righteousness. But what he finds instead is bloodshed. But in all of this, there's hope. And there's many places, even in this short reading, where hope is offered. In chapter 1, verse 19, if you're willing and obedient, you shall eat the good of the land. Notice in chapter 2, the reading that we've read so many times, and talking about the establishment of his kingdom to come, you know, at a later time. Chapter 4, beginning in verse 2, those that are faithful will be called holy. And so, all through even this short reading, here's Isaiah laying out to them what they're doing wrong and how they need to change. But notice what these sins are that the kings don't bring out. How the people themselves are oppressing the poor and oppressing the needy, and how they conduct themselves toward the unrighteous, bloodthirsty, money hungry. You see, it's descriptive of the people. And so the punishment that God is bringing upon, you know, Israel and Judah is not just because of the king. The king is a leader, has an influence upon him. But we can go into Jeremiah and we can see that the people loved it. You see, the people wanted, you know, to do these things. And so it's punishment upon the people because that's the heart that they have.